Well, good morning. I love that video because it gives reference to the fact, it reminds us that funny things happen in our family, right? I mean, crazy things can happen in our family. For my particular family, so often over the years, the funniest or craziest things that have happened in our family have been while we are with another family, specifically the Mattson family, okay? For instance, many years ago, we went on a water skiing trip together to Lake Isabella, and we got to Lake Isabella, and the conditions were terrible. We had to leave, and so we looked at a map, and we found a place called Lake Success, inappropriately named. Because when we took a shortcut that turned out to be a long cut and finally arrived at Lake Success, we discovered the Army Corps of Engineers was draining the lake. And there's like 100 yards of mud leading up to the lake. But undeterred, we took our lawn chairs and we stuck them in the mud and we sat there. Well, one year when we lived in Missouri, the Mattsons showed up to visit us and one of their daughters got a tick. Now, that's normal in Missouri, not so much in California. And so when Tony, her dad's plan to remove the tick started involving fire, a little yelling may have occurred in the household. And then finally, one year, we drove from Missouri to Colorado. They drove from California to Colorado. We borrowed a friend's cabin, sight unseen. We show up. Turns out the cabin was a shack, and it was full of mold, and there was no kitchen. Great times. A lot of great times. Other stuff happens in families too, right? Hard stuff. Devastating stuff. Difficult stuff. Families have favoritism that causes problems. People get sick and they die, right? Relationships sometimes deteriorate. Divorce. People leave. People get left behind. Financial crisis, health issues, you name it. Hard stuff happens in family. In fact, eventually every family, even the ones sitting here with you today, experience some of that devastation or difficulty or hard stuff we call the mess of being family. And that makes it daunting when we come to church to talk about family. Because although it's good to come together and talk about maybe our hope for family, what we'd like family to be, what it could be, the real question for many of us is, what about what's already happened in my family? Can God do anything with that? Or we might say it this way. Can God redeem what has already happened in my family? Can God make something good? Can there be resolution? Can there be redemption for what has already happened in my family? And that's what I'd like to talk to you about today, because I believe the answer is yes. Yes, God can redeem. God can work and bring good even to what has already happened in our family. But there have to be a couple of things that happen first. You see, when we experience the mess of family, it leaves us usually in one of two places. One of those places is regret or guilt over the part we've played in the mess of our family. Maybe it was our unwillingness to engage. Maybe it was the neglect. Maybe it was our addictions that we couldn't control. Maybe it was a decision, a choice. Maybe it was just something that happened. And we feel regret, carry guilt. Or when we talk about family, the mess for us, it means pain. It's the pain that we've experienced because of the mess, because of the choices, or because of the decisions, or just because of the circumstances, the things that have happened in our family. And if we're going to find redemption, if there's going to be a road to redemption, there has to be a way to deal with both sides of that coin, the regret and the guilt, or the pain, the anguish. And so when we consider the question, what can God do? How could God bring redemption to our family? I want us to see the possibilities in a story in the Old Testament around a family, frankly, that was in dire need of redemption. It's the story of Joseph and his brothers. Now, you may know something about Joseph. He was a dreamer, and he had a Technicolor dream coat, okay? But there's more to his story than that. So much more. Even for those of us who've been around the church and heard the stories, that there's more to the story than we sometimes realize. And so I want to dive into his story today. We're going to meet him in Genesis 42, and he and his brothers are going to be on a collision course orchestrated by God. So this is Genesis 42, verse 3. It just simply says, "Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt." And there's a lot of parts to this story. We don't have time to read all the verses, so I'm going to point out for you the highlights and tell you the rest, okay? But when it starts this way, 10 adult brothers of Joseph, they go down to Egypt to buy grain. It's not just a shopping trip, right? It's a life or death mission because there's a famine in the land. And it's such a devastating famine that literally this family is on the verge of starving to death. But they hear there's food available down in Egypt, and so they send these brothers, 10 of them, to buy food. And this is what sets them on a collision course, because something happens when they get to Egypt. Now, Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all of its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces on the ground. And that's important because of what it says in verse 8. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. And so they don't know that they have just come face to face with their own brother who happens to be the one who sells the grain in Egypt. And they don't know it, and they don't recognize it because they haven't seen him in 20 years. 20 years. It's been 20 years since the devastating event that defines their family occurred. You see, their family, the root of their issue was favoritism. The father in the family had a favorite, and it was Joseph, and everybody knew it. Right? Some of you know that pain. You know the pain of not being the favorite, or you know the pain of being the favorite. And the pressure that it brings. Well, this created great jealousy in their family between the brothers. And this jealousy boiled over one day into an unthinkable event. The 10 brothers sold Joseph into slavery. Now, these days we have a phrase for that. It's called human trafficking. That's what they did. They were going to kill him. But then they decided they might as well make some money off of him, and they sell him to a band of slave traders. And they go home and cover it up and lie to their father about it, and they live this way for 20 years. For Joseph, on his part, he ends up far from home in Egypt as a slave, a household slave. And he has quite the experience when one day he gets thrown in prison because he rejects the advances of his master's wife, and she doesn't like that, so she gets back at him by having him thrown in prison, and he languishes there for years. That's his experience. But God has given Joseph the ability to interpret dreams, and this gets him noticed. Even eventually noticed by the Pharaoh when Joseph interprets one of his dreams. And the Pharaoh comes to trust Joseph so much that eventually, after 20 years, he's now the governor of the entire nation of Egypt. And now, because of something that God has orchestrated, he's collided with this family. And it's a moment of decision. It's an opportunity for redemption. Because the story is set up perfectly, right? Here's Joseph, the victim of this terrible crime, who is now in power. And here are these brothers, the perpetrators of this horrendous crime, and they're on their knees in front of him. And so the story is set up for things to now be made right, for justice to be served, right? For redemption to occur. And we're going to walk through their story and see how God orchestrates this redemption. It's not going to happen in the way that you and I might expect. Notice what it says. This is verse 19. "If you are honest men," Joseph says, "let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households." Now, this is the end of a lot of story. It's a story where I think Joseph struggles with what to do now that he's reunited with his brothers. He takes advantage of the fact that they don't recognize him, and he's going to set up an elaborate test. And the test is designed to reveal to Joseph whether they have changed, whether redemption is possible, whether he could trust them. Or as it says in this verse, if they are honest men now. But Joseph is struggling with exactly how to do it. We know this because Joseph makes a first plan. The first plan is everybody stay in prison here. One of you go home. Because what he's learned from them is there's another brother. Joseph has a younger brother born after he was sold into slavery. And he wants to see this brother. And so he sets it up as a test. If what you're telling me is true, go home, one of you, and bring that brother back. But God's at work. God's at work because the next day Joseph wakes up and he says, God has said something to me and there has to be a new plan. And the new plan is just one of you stay in prison. But you've got to bring your brother back. You've got to bring your youngest brother to me so that I will know that you're not spies. And then I'll give your brother back to you. So they leave one of their brothers. His name is Simeon. They leave him in prison. And what Joseph wants to know is, will they abandon him there? Like they did with Joseph so many years ago. Or have they changed? And so imagine the scene. They leave Simeon there in prison and they head home and they're on this mission. The mission is to get Benjamin, who, by the way, is the new favorite. That's why he's still home with Dad. They've got to get this brother and head back so that they can buy more food and get Simeon out of prison. Right? That's the plan. But the plan hits a couple of snags on the way home. When they get home, they open their luggage and they find all the money they were supposed to pay for the food they bought, because they brought some food home. All of their money is still there, and they know eventually that's going to be an issue. The second snag comes when they relay this plan to their father, and he responds. Jacob, that's the father. He said, "Well, my son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead. He's the only one left." Can you hear the dysfunction? Can you hear the other 10 brothers saying, "We're right here, Dad." But they're stuck. Because what happens after Jacob says that is they don't go back. They abandon their brother, just like they did 20 years ago with Joseph. Their father is stuck in his pattern of favoritism. So this new favorite is worth more to him than the son that's in prison in Egypt, and he says, "I'm not going to send him. It's not worth it to me." And the brothers respond the way they always have, but they're going to abandon their brother and try to make it on their own. And think about Joseph these days. Think about Joseph. He's the one who wanted to set up this redemption or this family reunion. And so he sends them away, and each day he's hoping they'll come back, right? But day after day after day, it becomes more and more clear that they are not coming back. They have not changed. They are willing to leave a brother behind. And except for God being at work, that's where the story would end. It would end with this question: what would it ever take for there to be redemption? What would God have to do? What would they have to do to make anything different, to get out of these patterns that they have, that this is the way our family works? It works on favoritism and abandonment. Those are our issues. What would it take? What would have to happen? Maybe you are there and have asked that question about your own family. What would happen? Maybe you know what it's like to try and to hope and to wish that redemption would be possible. But every time you take a step, you get let down. You get met by other people who just can't see redemption happening. Or maybe you're on the other side and you're presented with a chance to make things right, to speak up, to talk about your part in the devastation that may have occurred or the tragedy or the difficulty in your family, but you just can't do it. You turn away every time. What'll it take to change? For this family in Genesis, what it takes is somebody getting hungry again, really hungry. Because what happens is they stay at home and they eat all of the food that they've purchased and they try to keep going until one day the famine has continued and they're going to starve to death again. And it's in that moment that the father becomes desperate enough to say, okay, I'll change my mind. And finally he says, okay, take your brother. Go back to the man. But there's something different this time. What's different is what he says next. And may God Almighty grant you mercy. That's different. In this story, if you read the whole text, this is the first time anyone calls on God. And specifically, he calls on God for mercy. If anything's going to change, if there's going to be redemption, it has to include mercy. And so they start by saying, God, have mercy. And he does. And it changes everything. They get back to Egypt, and they're shown into the palace, and they get told that they have to go to Joseph's house. And because of the guilt that they're carrying, because that's their part in the family, the regret and the guilt they're carrying, they're afraid. And so when they get told, listen, we want you all to go off over here to Joseph's house, this is their reaction. The men were frightened when they were taken to his house. They thought, he wants to attack us and overpower us and seize us as slaves and take our donkeys. And to be honest, we're not sure that's not what Joseph means also. At this point in the story, it isn't clear. And so they're afraid. And because they're afraid, they start babbling and they start confessing to Joseph's steward, his admin. We got home and the money was in our sacks and we didn't mean to do it, but we brought it back and we brought extra money and all this. And look at the response they get. It's the beginning of mercy. It's all right, he said. Don't be afraid. Your God The God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I received your silver. And then he brought Simeon out to them. So this is the beginning of God beginning to work out mercy in this situation. And it starts with this merciful reply from the steward who says, don't worry, you're not responsible. You don't owe us anything anymore. And by the way, here's your brother. He's out. He's free. And this response of mercy that they've asked for continues because eventually Joseph shows up at the house and he greets them, and they're still not sure what he's going to say. But this is how he responds to them. As he looked about, he saw his brother Benjamin, his own mother's son, and he asked, is this your youngest brother, the one you told me about? And he said, hear this, God be gracious to you, my son. And the Hebrew words here are the very same Hebrew words earlier when Jacob said, may God have mercy. Mercy, grace, compassion, they're the same word in Hebrew. And so this is evidence of God at work meeting them. God, will you have mercy? And the answer is yes. And Joseph's response to them is to have mercy. And then they have a feast, which is part of the gracious response of Joseph. It says, when portions were served to them from Joseph's table, Benjamin's portion was 5 times as much as anyone else's. And so they feasted and they drank freely with him because they've encountered a merciful response. And it's a key on this road to redemption. I told you that Joseph was struggling with how to respond to his brother. We see that and he makes different plans. He's not sure what to do, but ultimately, here's what Joseph does. He spent 20 years thinking, praying, wondering what would happen if they were reunited. And when he finds himself in a position of authority, in a position of power with the ability to make things right, he instead decides to extend mercy. And this is what mercy is. It's the genuine extending of forgiveness by someone who has experienced the full weight of the crime. Joseph had every right to exact revenge. He had the authority to do it. In our own day and age, we're familiar with the way that we treat human traffickers. And here's Joseph deciding something different. He extends mercy to them. And it changes everything. Mercy is a crucial part of this redemption in our families. There has to be this willingness, particularly, hear me, by those of us who have been on the receiving end, who've experienced pain. I'm not saying it's something you just go home today and decide to do. I know it's hard, it's difficult. And for many of us, it requires help. People to come alongside and to counsel us and to help us. But for all of us, mercy is a key. Joseph has one more test for them. He sends them all home the next morning after this feast, but this time he has his steward put all their money back in the sacks, but then he also has him put one of Joseph's silver cups, something precious and valuable. He puts it in the sack of Benjamin, the youngest son, and he's setting up another test. So they set off for home. Joseph's guys go and stop him and say, hey, we're missing a silver cup. And he says, then the steward proceeded to search, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. And so they haul them back in front of Joseph, and Joseph plays along and says, "What is this that you have done?" They've received mercy up to this point, but now they are stuck. But because mercy has been at work, it has a very different result and response in the lives of his brothers. Here's Judah. This is Judah, one of the brothers, speaking for the rest of them. Listen to how he responds. "What can we say to my Lord?" Judah replied. "What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt." And he's not just talking about the silver cup. He's talking about their whole lives. What can we say? God has uncovered our guilt. And Judah, he went on and he said, "I guess we'll be your slaves now. That's what we deserve." And Joseph says, "Oh no. No, no, I wouldn't do that. You don't all have to be slaves. Just the one who had the cup, Benjamin, the favorite." And the test is, would these brothers do what they've always done? Will they abandon one to save themselves, to preserve themselves? Or have they changed? And because mercy's been having its work, there's a very different response this time. Judah says, "Listen, we can't do this. I can't leave this boy with you. Please, let your servant," he means himself, "let your servant remain here as my Lord's slave in place of the boy. Let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, don't let me see the misery that would come on my father." Listen, he has not been concerned about the misery of his father for 20 years. You know, when he sold his son into slavery and lied about it, when he abandoned his other one because he couldn't stand up to his father's favoritism. But now on the other side of receiving mercy, he's able to be humble. He's able to humble himself and say, "I can't do that to him. I can't do that to the boy. Take me. I'll take their place." And it's a humble response, and it demonstrates that the brothers have changed, that mercy has been met now by humility. And humility is the response that's necessary for redemption if those of us who have guilt, those of us who feel regret, if we're going to be able to come to the table, our part is humility. And again, it's not something you may just go ahead and decide and do on the spot. It might take you time. You might need trusted people to come alongside you and help you in this process. But if there's going to be redemption for what has already happened in your family, it's going to include two things: mercy and humility. And that's what happened in their family. And it's at this moment when Judah demonstrates this humility, this ability to account for his guilt, that Joseph can no longer contain himself. And he says to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because, well, they were terrified at his presence. Imagine them realizing that all along this has been the brother they trafficked. He's been hearing and seeing the entire scene. And they're terrified, and Joseph says, "No, no, no, you don't have to be terrified. Come close. Come here. Let's get close." And redemption becomes possible, and Joseph says the most amazing thing. And now he says, listen to these words: "Do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." And this is the work of God in Joseph's life. It begins with mercy, and it's met by humility, and it results in redemption because Joseph begins to see something, and that is that God has a plan for this family. God, he says, sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. what we sometimes lose track of the fact is that this is the most important family in the Bible. The father, Jacob, his name gets changed to Israel. These sons, they become the patriarchs, the heads of the clans of the nation of Israel, God's people. The whole story of the Old Testament is about them, and it's from them that God will give a Messiah to the world. But from our vantage point, none of that happens without this redemptive process. Because if Joseph can't find mercy and he sends them away or he keeps them in prison, the family will be extinguished, either by starvation or a life in prison. And if the brothers do not summon the courage to turn around and head back to Egypt the second time, and if on the third time when they get caught, they aren't able to say, "We're guilty," then the family's going to starve to death, languish away in prison. But God has a plan. God has a purpose. And hear this today. God's purpose for their family and your family is not ruined by our weaknesses. Let me say that again. There are consequences to our decisions, to our failings, to the junk we just bring into our families from our families. There are devastating consequences, of course, but God's purposes are not defeated. With God, redemption is always possible. I don't know where this story finds you today, but I want to encourage you that God's story in your life and for your family is one that works over the incredible arc of time. You might not see it where you're sitting right now. You might wonder how there could ever be mercy or how there ever could be humility that could ever result in redemption, but I want you to hear something. No matter what has happened in your family already, God's purpose is for you. God's plans are not defeated. And he can bring redemption. And that is good. Good news. So I don't know where you find yourself today. Maybe you're in the place of regret and guilt for what you couldn't do or haven't done. Maybe what you did do. I want you to hear that the road to redemption for you begins with humility. And if you're on the side of the coin where you've received pain, where you're even the victim, the road to redemption for you is going to start with mercy, real mercy. And through these things, God can and will redeem what's happened in your family because his promises, his purposes, his plan for you and your family, they stand. Let's pray together today.